So, hey guys, welcome back. We have a new one for you, and this is a returning guest. We have Nathan Ward on the phone. We spoke to Nathan Ward back on September 22nd, 2023, and it was regarding his book called The Son of the Old West, The Odyssey of Charlie Siringo, Cowboy Detective and Writer of the Wild Frontier. And that was by Nathan Ward. Now, if you want to find out more about Nathan and getting this book about Charlie Siringo, go on Amazon. The hardback and soft cover are both available, as well as a Kindle. And he's going to talk a little bit about, soon he'll talk a little bit about how it's also, I think it's on a, you have it on a recording, right? You have a guest reader?
J. Rodney Taylor does a great job with it, yeah. Now when I read it, you know, out loud myself, I feel like a fraud because he sounds so real, authentic.
There you go. So we have Nathan Ward back, and we're going to talk about why Nathan Ward is back. And we're not going to talk about any drumming this time, none. So Mark Lee Gardner, if you're listening, no drumming. Of course, I want to thank my friends over. I want to thank my friends over at Tombstone Epitaph. One of Arizona's longest running newspapers at tombstoneepitaph.com. I urge you to subscribe and get it delivered right to your door because Mark and Eric and the team are putting out an awesome newspaper about the Wild West. You can do so by going to tombstoneepitaph.com. And my second family over at the Wild West History Association at wildwesthistory.org. They just came out with a brand new membership. Now, they have all sorts of memberships, but they have a brand new one that's for $60. And if you live in Europe or overseas or Canada or somewhere where shipping is really expensive and you want to get the journal right away, for $60, you can become a member and you can get a digital journal emailed right to your door, right to your inbox. And that is an awesome way. It's $60. It's a brand new membership. But instead of getting the journal where you can feel it and touch it, or and it might take you 2 to 3 weeks to get, now they'll email it to your inbox. You can keep it on your laptop, and you can read it whenever you want. So make sure you go to the Wild West History Association and join at wildwesthistory.org. So again, we have Nathan Ward on the phone, and Nathan and I did a podcast, like I said, back in September 22nd, 2023. So go back in the archives and listen to it. Nathan talks about his story, how he got interested in Wild West history. We talked a lot about drumming because I didn't know that he was a drummer. We talked all about Charlie Siringo's life. But at the end, I felt like the book really, we had more to say. And so we're going to do, today's podcast is really more of a, maybe an open discussion. We're going to be going in different places and talking about different things with no real structure. And it's more just a couple of guys on the phone talking about Charlie. When I mentioned in the earlier of the podcast about how Nathan affected me, I'm a safety manager for an air conditioning company. I get to travel all across the country. And last year, I got to travel to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And when I got to Coeur d'Alene, in Charlie's or Nathan's book about Charlie Siringo, there was some mention about the town of Gem, Idaho and Burke, Idaho. And I thought, oh, I'm in Idaho? I'm in Coeur d'Alene? I wonder how far Gem and Burke is. And I did a search and found out that Gem was like 45 minutes away. So I had my truck, my rental car, and I drove all the way 45 minutes to the Wallace exit. And I got off, I went under the freeway and drove up the canyon to Gem and Burke. And there, even though the buildings were gone, many of the buildings were gone, except for the big mine up in Burke. But there in Gem, I could visually see the layout of the town of Gem and where and how Charlie Siringo had ended up in Gem, and I took all these photos, and luckily I had great service, I don't know why, but in this valley, and I started sending these photos to Nathan, and I'm like, dude, you affected me in this book. I drove to see Gem, and I started just texting photos, and they were just like, And I am I right? You got pretty excited by the photos because I kept sending you more and I'm taking pictures. And I think you were able to even visualize how the town was laid out and the river went around behind the...
I was amazed how much it matched up with the pictures of the mining camp from when he was there. I have to say, for interviews, you go the extra mile with the research.
Well,
it was quite interesting. Yeah,
but it would have been a huge waste for me to be in Coeur d'Alene and then say, well, Jim is 45 minutes away, and not go, well, it's too far, I'm going to go to Applebee's instead. You know, it would be too... That's... it would... true. Have been dumb.
That is true.
So to go to Jim and stand there and talk about how the fact, which we did in the first podcast, about how he infiltrated the miners union and then he was like found out and he was underneath the buildings and am I right so far? He's crawling underneath the buildings trying to escape being caught, and then he climbs up this hillside and he's up on top of this mountain hiding out. I could visualize it from the photos, and it totally made sense.
That's true. It was a very excellent job of fact checking his story. That's right. I was very impressed. You're like Walter Camp, the railroad construction engineer he became one of the greatest historians of Custer, because he would, wherever he was, he'd look up whatever survivors they were from the Battle of Little Bighorn, and he'd interview them sometimes 3-4 times as he went around the country. It's great to take advantage of that travel like that.
Well,
in the service of history.
Well, I'm a person, I love black and white photos, you know, from the 1800s. But I'm a person that says, okay, that's the photo in the 1800s. What does it look like now? Yeah, and Deadwood was one of those places that I went to a couple of summers ago because of the my membership with the Wild West History Association. And I went there and I saw it. And I'm like, wow, it looks... there's Seth Bullock's grave, and there's, you know, the buildings that are in the black and white photos, and there's Main Street, and there's Wall Street, and there's this, and there's the Mount Moriah Cemetery. And and I was like, there it is. It's in black and white, and there it is in color, and I'm standing there. That's the type of person I am. I love black and white photos, but I'm like, I want to go see it now. Even if it's just a tree stump, I'm going to be like, well, that's cool, because there's the tree. They cut it down, and today it's a tree stump. Like, I don't care. I think Tombstone is the same way. I get to see Tombstone. Johnny Ringo's grave in Cochise County is that way. They're just places where I go, and I'm like, I got to see what it looks like today. But in our podcast, after we did all that, and I went to Jim, we spent way more time on the phone. Done the phone than we should have, because we were talking about the photos and the excitement. I was excited, and I was excited to share it with you. We talked a little bit about coming back to a part two, but more of a revisit. And so today's podcast really isn't a part two, but a revisit, because Charlie Siringo shows up everywhere. And here's an example, and then we'll talk about it. I just finished a book by Mark Lee Gardner called To Hell on a Fast Horse, Billy the Kid, Pat Garrett, and the Epic Chase to Justice in the Old West.
An excellent book.
And on page 184, Mark makes this little tiny paragraph, and it says about Fort Sumner Cemetery and where Billy the Kid is buried. And here's what Mark wrote. Page 184. 38 years after the publication of Garrett's The Authentic Life, Charlie Siringo, who had been a member of the Texas Posse, claimed that Garrett had Billy's body dug up to make sure that the trigger finger was still attached. And it was. But like Upson, Siringo could not resist improving upon a story. And that was based upon the fact that there was discussion that Billy the Kid's trigger finger had been cut off, put in a jar of like formaldehyde, and was taken around the country for people to see, and then eventually put in storage.
Yeah, it was rumored there was somebody's finger floating around in a jar in New York, and then the Nevada papers picked it up, and then another guy started to sell. He had somebody's bones on strings, and you could come see those, and he said those are Billy's bones. God knows where they got these bones. And it was a great business because people were so obsessed with Western outlaws, especially people in the East reading these newspapers where they, you know, they juiced it up a little bit anyway. But the thing about that story is Siringo then, when he really needed money, he wrote his own life of Billy, which is almost entirely the lore, because he only met him very briefly. It made a huge impression on him because he wrote more about Billy the Kid than about anyone except for himself over his five books. But he didn't know him very long, and he wasn't part of the party that caught him, obviously. Mm-hmm. But the thing about I learned from sort of checking his stories through his many autobiographies was the surprising thing was if it was his story that he saw, he would do that sort of frontier deadpan pretending to downplay it. And those checked out a lot more often than if it was someone else's story and he had not been a witness. And in that case, especially if they didn't write it very well, in his opinion, he would improve other people's stories. That is one of them. There's the death of Henry Brown, who was lynched in Medicine Lodge, Kansas. And even though that's a pretty dramatic scene, the Henry Brown, they were, you know, strung up in trees like the way they traditional frontier lynching, but he has one of the bullets lighting his coat on fire because it was such a close shot, and he runs into the dark and it's lit so it was easy to target him a second time in the dark. Now that is how you would do it in a movie, but it's not actually what happened, but it's somebody else's story and Charlie wasn't there and he just can't help improving on it, which is, you know, the storytelling tradition. But I was surprised when I spent so much time with Charlie over the pandemic that his own stories that he was a witness to were not exaggerated, especially as he got older. You would think the old man would improve his youthful adventures. But it was whenever he brought in someone else's story as filler or transition, that's when you had to really watch him, because it's he's a good storyteller.
But how? I get that he's a storyteller, and I get that part. What baffles my mind is that he shows up like he interjected himself into places maybe where he shouldn't have been. Or was that done on purpose, do you think? Do you think it was done on purpose because he was looking for the good story? Or that he was looking for a way to make money?
Well, he met a lot of people, and surely he wanted to sell some books. And he sure didn't mind when people talked about him, if that's what you mean. Yeah. But it's a weird combination where you think, well, all of this is going to turn out to be self-promoting exaggeration. And then you know, you can find a lot of things online now that you couldn't 10 years ago for fact checking, for instance. And that's what I'm getting at. Something like where his wife died, his first wife died of bursitis lungs. And he has this scene where it was winter and she was coughing out the window as he held her. And then she died. And it was one of the terrible things that ever happened to him, and he probably never got over it. And but in his book, he remembers it as winter. And if you go online, her obituary is in August. Mm-hmm. So that kind of thing, it's just more dramatic and sad. if it happens in the dark of winter. But it doesn't change the actual facts of what happened.
So you'd also mention, though, and I haven't gotten this far yet in his my research of Charlie, you also mentioned that he was involved with Butch Cassidy?
Well, yeah. Yes, when he became a Pinkerton, after the famous robbery of Wilcox, James McParland, who was in charge of the Denver office then, he recommended his two best guys to go undercover. One was Siringo, and the other was his partner, Billy Sales. And they spent 4 years chasing the Wild Bunch, mostly Kid Curry, because at the beginning they thought Kid Curry was the head of the gang. And he never got over that either. He never accepted that Kid Curry died. No matter how many times he was shown pictures of his corpse or newspaper accounts, he just went on chasing him in his mind till the end.
In your book,
I said in the book, he's like a phantom limb. You know, it's gone, but you can't accept that it's gone.
In your book, we even had some joke. We were laughing a little bit on the pre-interview before we started recording about really how he showed up in weird places. And in your book, which is, again, it's available on Amazon, a bookseller's called The Son of the Old West, Odyssey of Charlie Siringo, Cowboy Detective, Writer of the Wild Frontier by Nathan Ward. On page 287, weirdest thing ever, there's a backyard portrait of Siringo with a rifle that wounded Billy the Kid in a dark-suited Pawnee Bill in 1927. Like, how does he end up with a rifle that wounded Billy the Kid in 1927 with a guy named Pawnee Bill?
Well, that particular gathering was for his final book, Riata and Spurs, where he got a real publisher, Houghton Mifflin, and they didn't know about that much about his earlier legal trouble with the Pinkertons over telling the truth about his cases. Because at that point he had been sued 3 times by them because he just kept publishing because he felt it was his life to tell about, and they felt that they didn't want their clients' names. They didn't want, you know, they made him change a lot. He even had to call them the Dickinson Agency in his famous book Cowboy Detective. But anyway, for his final book, he told them all of that was forgotten. He's old now, and he was going to tell the truth from beginning to end. So that's supposed to be his entire life. Cowboys, detectives, outlaws, the whole deal. And of course the Pinkertons immediately sued, and they had to pulp the first edition of his book and take out every reference to his detective career. And it was heartbreaking. But anyway, that was in March 1927, that picture, because his friends and people from Hollywood who wanted to be his friends came out to his son's house where he was living in Altadena, and they gave him a party and told tales from the old frontier. And I'm sure that gun was loaned by his friend William S. Hart, who also owned Billy's pistol, because at the book party that they subsequently had, he had those as props on the stage and sort of aimed them into the audience, and people were thrilled because it was, you know, the Billy's gun and then Siringo all together in one picture. So that's what's going on there. I think that was on loan from Bill Hart, but I'd have to check into it.
Because Bill Hart plays a big part of the last years of Charlie's life, correct? Because in your in your book, you covered the Hollywood years, chapter 30. I like what you wrote, or actually William Hart wrote. It says that the bigness of the West makes men quiet. Quote.
Under yeah, that's a good line, right?
It's a terrific line. But it, in a way, even though it says the bigness of the West makes men quiet, Charlie really wasn't quiet. He was always looking for the angle.
That's right.
So how's it that he ended up in Hollywood? Because talk about the Hollywood years and his relationship eventually with William Hart.
Well, he followed a transition that a lot of the old the grizzled frontiersmen followed, which was to, if they're going to be making movies about the West, I want to get out there and they can tell my story and hopefully they'll pay me something. Emmett Dalton was there, Wyatt Earp was there. They all went and most of them hung out with Bill Hart as if Bill Hart was going to make their movie. I mean, I think he also was enormously thrilled to have these authentic guys hanging around with him, because he's really a guy from New York with a New York accent, an old fashioned patrician New York accent. But he was a good writer, and he was everybody's favorite cowboy actor until Tom Mix. What was I trying to say? Oh yes. So he went out there because a friend had written to him that there were he could make money out here with his skills, riding and roping. And by the time he got out there, though, he was, you know, he had chronic bronchitis and he couldn't really ride much. But he still had a story that he could tell, and she tried to write for the cowboy magazines. And he was just it was an interesting place to be. And there were all these guys hanging out in these, Hollywood cowboy bars. They loved listening to him, but he didn't make much money off it. People were all thrilled to meet him or invite him to parties as an exotic figure. But he was, as far as I can tell, he was only hired twice to be an advisor. And the last one was Bill Hart's last film, Tumbleweeds, and that's worth seeing just for Charlie's 45 seconds of a cameo where he's in a bar, he's playing some bizarre instrument, you can't even see what the thing is he's strumming, but just to see him live like that, it's a thrill.
Wow. Charlie was just, I'm sitting here listening to you. I don't know why. I'm just, I always listen to the, I listen to, if you're wondering, I listen to the pod, the interview as much as I do when I listen to the podcast. I'm just waiting for Nathan to continue on. I'm good. But Hollywood really wasn't that good for him, correct?
Well, I think he was going to be in decline wherever he was at that point in his physical life. He could no longer really ranch, and his ranch was in hopeless debt from his funding his various lawsuits with the Pinkertons. So he had to sell that. He could have stayed with his daughter, I suppose, but that wasn't, a great life for a guy who had lived as freely as he had. Once his health was good enough to go live on his own again, he moved out of his daughter's place in California, and he got a series of apartments around Hollywood. And as his lungs got better or worse, he would move various places, thinking that, well, I need to live closer to the water for my lungs. I lived, okay, now I feel better. I'm going to move back to where the action is in Hollywood, and I can hang out with Bill Hart again. It's little moves like that. But he didn't own a horse at that point. I don't think he ever drove a car. So he was sort of dependent on people driving him out to their parties in the Hollywood Hills, and he really didn't have very much money. when the Los Angeles Times reporter visited his house. It was a cabin that had been built in the backyard of one of his friend's buildings, and there was a leak in the roof while the reporter was there. And he said the air was good for his lungs. You know, he was a very proud person, but obviously he didn't have the money he needed. And Bill Hart offered to loan him money, and as far as I can tell, he refused, and then he gave him the job advising on Tumbleweeds, which was a recreation of the Caldwell, Kansas that he had lived in. So the saloon is per his memories. I mean, it must have been a thrill to like actually physically recreate your remembered town like that, because he was there right before the land rush. And that's what the movie is about. He's in scenes in the bar. That was his role. And the movie has its own, melancholy side, because Hart refused to cut it down. They wanted it to be 3 reels, and I think it was 5 reels, and he just refused. And in revenge, the studio didn't distribute it widely across the country, so he didn't really get a chance to take off, even if it wasn't over long. But the good side of that was that he, you know, any cold editing job of that film would say, you got to take, what is this weird old guy in the bar? Let's take him out. That'll save us 40 seconds. And let's take this out. You know, there's all kinds of things you would have cut, but then you wouldn't have Charlie Seringo in a film, and that would be too bad. So from my perspective, I'm sorry that if the movie failed and it was Bill Hart's last film, but I'm so glad to have footage of actual Charlie Seringo in a bar. He looks like a tough customer.
In what movie again is that?
That's Tumbleweeds.
Tumbleweeds.
It's online. You just type in Tumbleweeds. There's in the book, I say exactly where he appears, so you don't have to watch the whole thing if you don't feel deeply about the Oklahoma land rush. But it's fantastic for that, because they use 300 riders. You know, there's like 75 buckboards, and they're just like flying across the country when the whistle goes off.
That's crazy.
And it's been copied by other films since then, but it is too long. If you look at it with Seringo aside, it is too long. But it's freely available on online, on YouTube and elsewhere. But there's 2 versions. One he appears like just before the hour point, and the other point, in the book I have the exact.
But I mean, it's crazy, because you think about all the opportunities that Wyatt Earp had to be on film, mm-hmm. and he had opportunities galore and never appeared. And Charlie Seringo, who was nowhere near the stature, I think, of Wyatt Earp during that time, you know, ends up on film. And, you know, it's crazy to think about. You can now actually sit and watch a guy from the 1800s that we read about and have the crazy career. I mean, it was a crazy career. And hunting down people and tracking people and detective work and all sorts of stuff. It ends up on a film.
Well, the flip side of that was, he did all these things under different names. So his adventures, his life story was not as natural, obviously, as Wyatt Earp's story or Doc Holliday's story or, you know, all these guys, because he didn't do them as himself. He was always these different aliases around the country pretending to be different characters. You wouldn't start out knowing him as a household name, is what I'm saying. And so that's one reason his movie never got made. A lot of them. But the other reason was, if you take Emma Dalton, for example, who moved out there and tried to be a screenwriter and did make two movies as himself. Hollywood from the start, they didn't feel they needed his permission. The fictional Dalton Brothers was good enough for most people. They just wanted to see rioting and shooting. Emmett Dalton had to sue a guy who was writing magazine stories using the writing name Emmett Dalton. And they were, what it was like with the gang, which with the gang till he was 19 when they were all shot. But that's my point, is that the public was not super into is this the authentic story? They were willing to put up with a fake Emmett Dalton who he sued him for $1 million. Because, I'm still alive. You can't tell my story as me. But the appetite was so great that kind of thing was, it fell by the wayside.
Maybe a bad word choice of words. Like, I don't think Charlie ever got the success that he was hoping for. Like, he did all these wonderful things, and then I could be wrong, if I was in his shoes, I'd be like, why me? Why did I never get the success that I mean, I've done all these amazing things, and here I am living in a cabin in the back.
I agree. Well, there's something in him that money did not stick to him. It's not like he had a lot of money that he got rid of. It's just, when you think of all the cattle kings that he worked for in the very earliest days in Texas, where, he had his little branding iron. He could have made his own ranch of mavericks. But he worked for everybody who became rich off that business. And not him. And then he moved on because he saw that the trail life was coming to an end. And he ended up in Kansas. And that's where, when he thought he was retired from the cowboy life, that's where he wrote the first boy memoir. Then he moved to Chicago thinking, well, now I'm going to be this sort of literary cowboy writer. And I'll oversee the production of the second edition of this book. And then the bombings happened, and he got excited to join the Pinkertons. So I think he just went with life to a certain point. But he certainly had opportunities to make money if that had ever been very important to him at the beginning.
Well, you brought up the Pinkertons. And again, it's odd where he shows up. He wrote a book called The Lost Detective.
You mean I did?
What's that?
You mean I did?
Yeah, what did I write? What did I say?
Oh, I thought you said he wrote a book called The Lost Detective.
What do you mean? The Lost Detective by Nathan Ward. If you want another book, and we're going to do a podcast about this one. He's already said yes. Even if he said no, he said yes. It's called The Lost Detective, and it's not Dashiell Hammett. A lot of people call him Dashiell Hammett. It's Dashiell Hammett. And so it's called The Lost Detective, Becoming Dashiell Hammett by Nathan Ward. And I'm not a suspense reader. I don't read suspense novels or books. But the history that is in it is so crazy, from Dashiell being a Pinkerton and Siringo, that Nathan wrote this in his book. Again, and The Lost Detective is available on Amazon. Make sure you get it. It's called The Lost Detective, Becoming Dashiell Hammett by Nathan Ward. All Pinkertons signed an agreement against disclosure, and the fate of the cowboy detective Charlie Siringo had shown that even the most sanitized detective memoir could be punished by the Pinkertons. So Hammett had to create his own mythical agency, as lawyers had forced poor Siringo to do. A fan of inside jokes to amuse himself, Hammett named the firm employed that his operative or op, the Continental Detective Agency, after the Continental Building in Baltimore, where he had first been hired by the Pinkertons, and he gave it a location that is clearly modeled on the Flood Building in San Francisco. So even in a book about Dashiell Hammett, the great detective writer, operative, San Francisco, writing suspense novels, Charlie Siringo shows up there as well. Talk about that, can you?
Well, that's, you know, that's where I got the idea for this book, was that I went to Washington, and I went to the Pinkerton Archives in the Library of Congress, which is a wonderful place, and because it's all still physical stuff. So if you are looking for, they'll give you all the reports out of the Baltimore office in 1915, and it comes in a box, and you go through them all. You know, everybody's watching houses for the clients, and man observed leaving 9:15 goes, but you know, everything that is the standard cop show stuff now was not usually part of a detective story before Hammett started, because that was thought to be too nuts and bolts, and people wanted the genius Sherlock Holmes type. He goes out to the country estate and the murder, and he assembles everybody in a room at the end, and he brilliantly tells them who did it, even though he doesn't talk to anybody, or, you know, he just knows. Anyway, Hammett is the opposite of that, because he had done these reports, and he thought if you follow the actual operative around, that's a more interesting American kind of story. That's how crime actually happens and is solved when it's solved. So I went there to find, you know, everybody says never found any thing actually tying him to the agency where he said he worked. And of course I did not find his op reports, because those were the property of the client. So if let's say Unilever had hired the detectives to find theft in their factory or something, those reports would go back to Unilever, because legally they don't want to get that. So it's not so suspicious that his particular reports would not be there.
Are you moving around the room?
Or sometimes it's op number 23, that kind of thing.
Are you moving around the room? Are you in one spot?
What's that?
Do you talk and are you moving around the room?
No.
Oh, because it broke up a little bit. So I thought maybe
I
thought maybe you were standing up and walking around, because I do better when I walk around on the phone.
Oh, all right. Well, I'll walk around. Had I gotten to Washington when I cut off?
No. You did okay. It was just breaking up. I didn't want to miss anything in your storytelling.
Okay. Well, I guess I was talking about going to the Library of Congress.
Yes.
Pinkerton Archive.
Yeah. Keep going.
And then okay.
I screwed your train of thought, didn't I?
At the Library of Congress, they have all these operative reports. They did not have Hammett's that I could find, but they had a lot about Charlie Siringo, both the stories lauding his infiltration of the Wild Bunch gang and other crimes, but then a whole file of their legal drafts trying to shut him down when he just kept trying to write his life story, and they kept saying, no, you know, so much of your life story is our story, and you don't have the right to say that. And that sort of fascinated me. So the combination of my not finding what I was there to see, I ended up copying all these things, the Siringo folders. And then I was very lucky to do that, because when I then signed to do a book about him a couple of years later, it was 9 months before the pandemic hit and every library in the world closed down. So I couldn't have gone back there for 3 or 4 years if I wanted to. So I luckily I had this little, pile of papers in my study about Charlie Seringo, and I was able to make a start with that. And that, you know, it just painted the picture of a very intriguing person. Whether their view of him was entirely correct or not, it did give me a way in that I would not have had if I hadn't made those copies.
Well, if you do get The Lost Detective, which I urge you to do, it is available on Amazon. And like I said, Nathan will come back and do one, because I didn't know anything about Dashiell Hammett and learned a lot. Focus on the first chapter. The first chapter is called The Devilish Art. And in that chapter is a whole bunch about Charlie Seringo, the limits of the Pinkerton's tolerance, all sorts of stuff is in here. And really a fantastic read. When I read the book about Son of the Old West, about Charlie, I then read Dashiell Hammett and was blown away at how they were connected. Like I said, I just finished this week. In fact, it was yesterday. I just finished To Hell on a Fast Horse and was shocked to see that Charlie Seringo showed up there. It's like when you read books about a person and they show up in multiple historians and multiple authors and multiple books is when you realize how big a person is to a timeline. And Charlie Seringo is a major part of the 1800s.
He did get around. He did meet almost everyone you'd want him to meet. It was an interesting way to do a sort of Western history, because everyone else I considered writing about, they didn't see everything the way he seemed to see it. I wanted to write about Emma Dalton originally, and my editor said, but Charlie saw more of the West. If you want to do it sort of a history of the West through a person, there aren't that many others. He was sent everywhere. So that's what I ended up doing. I still would love to write about Emma Dalton, but Charlie saw more outlaws, frankly.
Well, I'd love to see a movie about him. It sounds, when you read the book and then you see the connections with Butch Cassidy, Dashiell, Billy the Kid, like it would make a fascinating movie. Was a movie ever made, or is there anything out there that's floating around YouTube that somebody tried to do that you maybe have seen?
Well, he appears in a lot of things because he's usually the one Pinkerton that screenwriters have heard of. So then they put him in there. He's usually like a humorless manhunter, trigger happy. Even Cole Hauser played him in this Lizzie Borden show a couple of years ago. You know, he shoots a guy in the first scene, he shoots a guy in another, you know, it's just like, it has no relation to what he did, which was, he was in disguise, he would seduce the girlfriends of the outlaws and get access to their letters so he'd know the addresses they wrote from, you know, that kind of stuff. But so often in these Westerns, they just, you know, they think people just want to see shooting, whether the guy shot people or not. And even when I was doing this book, my dad said, don't tell people he didn't shoot anyone. They won't buy your book. So I guess it's too late now.
Well, I think it's funny. So again, we're talking.
But I think he'd be great to like cable series or something. I mean, you can really do the whole West through his life. You'd have to have two different actors or something, but I think Tim Blake Nelson or somebody like that would be an excellent Charlie.
Well, I just finished a podcast with Sam Dolan. Mm-hmm. He's an executive producer on a show that's on INSP network called Into the Wild Frontier. Mm-hmm. And I think he would be perfect. I think we should approach Nathan and say, listen, or not Nathan, but Sam, and say, listen, can we crank one out about Charlie Sorengo. He'd be perfect for Into the Wild Frontier.
You would think that an actor would love it because you're a different character every week.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a miner this week, then you're an executive the next week, then you're pretending to be a bank robber, But it's not up to me.
What was that time travel show that used to be on where he would show up as different characters every time? People are yelling it out right now. They're like, "Oh my God, that's the guy." Not Briscoe County Jr., gosh darn it. Somebody will text it to me. If you know, you know. His name was Sam. I think the guy's name was Sam, and he would time travel, and he'd show up as a woman, or he'd show up, and he would have to fix the clues. People, they know. Mark Lee Gardner's like yelling right now into the phone, it's this. It'd be kind of cool to see that. Yeah, I agree. You working on anything new? I think the last time we talked, you were. But it wasn't history related, correct?
Well, I have two things that I'm trying to do, and that's up to my editor now, which of them I do. One is about Curly the Crow and Little Big Horn. And the other is about Houdini and the Spiritualists in the 20s. We'll see.
See, those have a tie-in to the late 1800s because they're all... You know, even though Houdini, I mean, he still was, he was born in the late 1800s, correct?
Correct. Yes, he was.
Well, so when do you have those in the can as far as all done, but waiting to be proofread?
Oh, no. I'm just working away on them and seeing which one I do.
Okay, well, I always tell people that I talked to the family, I was going to say, well, I talked to the Ward family and they said, they're tired of you screwing around, and you need to get something done.
Yeah.
You got anything going on personally, though? Like, you still doing the detective writing and the short stories?
Yeah, sometimes I do. Yes, sometimes. It's interesting. It's interesting what there's a market for and what there isn't. It's.
Okay. And what about drumming? You doing any stuff in a band?
No, I'm not. Okay. I'm not. I do have my drum set here, but I promise not to talk about it.
You know, what's so weird is I did a safety topic at one of our offices in Southern California, and I use a flat screen, and I tie it into my laptop, and I've got some Rush videos on my, and I'll play some Rush. I'll log into a YouTube and I'll go Rush mix, and the branch manager walks by and he goes, "Whoop!" He's, "Hey, is that Rush?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Are you a Rush fan?" And I go, "Well, I'm really a Neil Peart fan." And he goes, "Oh my God!" He goes, "I'm a drummer. Are you a drummer too?" And I'm like, all of a sudden, I'm doing my best not to talk about drumming, and here I am talking in an office. We're talking about Neil Peart. So, all right. Well, it's good to know. And it's good to know you got some stuff in the works, so we'll have some more to talk about. Again, we're talking to Nathan Ward. He's written a book. He wrote a book called Son of the Old West, The Odyssey of Charlie Sorengo, Cowboy, Detective, and Writer of the Wild Frontier. That is available on Amazon. You can get it on Amazon and booksellers near you. Amazon, if you're somebody who has a high cost of shipping and want to get it, is probably your best bet. We did speak about his other book called The Lost Detective, Becoming Dashiell Hammett, by Nathan Ward. It is all about the life and times and a very tumultuous life in a way with Dashiell. He really went through a lot and also caused a lot of his own problems. That would be a safe thing to say. Caused a lot of his own problems. I was very surprised because they didn't know about Dashiell. I knew nothing about him, even though, again, because people call him Dashiell, it's actually Dashiell. I didn't really understand him as a man and the amount of problems that he caused himself. He could have had just an easy, freaking easy life, but he caused a lot of his own problems. But again, it's called The Lost Detective, Becoming Dashiell Hammett by Nathan Ward. So there's some great reading out there. Also, because we did mention it, To Hell on a Fast Horse Billy the Kid, Pat Garrett and the Epic Chase to Justice and the Old West by Mark Lee Gardner. You're going to want to get that one because it does mention Charlie Seringo, as well as the YouTube stuff. You could probably mention his name. You got anything else? Is there any other thing, books out there that mention Charlie, like you said?
I would be a stupid person if I didn't mention my method book festival this March.
The who?
The Tucson Book Festival.
Yeah.
I'm appearing there.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this, looks like I'm going to have to make a drive down to Tucson.
All right. I don't know why. It seems to be the same weekend as the Tombstone Book Festival. I think those guys want to get it together. But so I can't do both, but I am. That's the one I'm going to, is the Tucson Book Festival.
Okay. So if I come down with the books, will you autograph them?
I guess that's what I'm supposed to do, yeah.
What are you supposed to do? Listen, I drove all the way to Jem, Idaho, and I spent beating down bushes to get into the pictures for you, and you're going to say, I guess I can. That's all.
I'll be there.
That's a total lie. I drove an air conditioned four-wheel drive.
I'm supposed to speak. On the Saturday and the Sunday.
Sunday.
It's two and different what, it's panels. March, that's all I know.
What is it? March what?
The 8th, 9th, or 9th, 10th, whatever that weekend is. 8th, 9th. You think I should get this together before I come on?
No, because March 9th, oh my God, March 9th, I'm heading to Georgia. I'm flying to Georgia, and on the 10th, I'm going to spend the afternoon with Dr. Gary Roberts, who is the authority on Doc Holliday and wrote the book about Doc Holliday. And so he's going to meet me on Sunday, the 10th. We're supposed to go to Griffin. He's going to show me the birthplace of Doc Holliday and some cool places.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's on the 9th.
Oh, that's a good weekend.
Yeah, that's on the 10th. So I may not make it. I may not make it on the 9th. I think I'm flying on the 9th.
All right.
So hell with you then. But anyways, good to talk to you again, man. If you want to know more about Nathan, go back to the September 22nd, 2023. Nathan Ward, that's when we had our last chat, is in the archives. He's written a book called The Son of the Old West, The Odyssey of Charlie Seringo, Cowboy, Detective, and Writer of the Wild Frontier. He's also written a book that's got Charlie Seringo mentioned in it, The Lost Detective, Becoming Dashiell Hammett by Nathan Ward. And then our good friend that mentions Charlie Seringo, To Hell on a Fast Horse by Mark Lee Gardner, Billy the Kid, Pat Garrett, and the Epic Chase to Justice in the Old West. As always, you can find me on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you listen to podcasts. Please leave a rating and a review. If you want to find out more about the Wild West History Association, you can go on their YouTube page and also their Facebook page. And Dave Guyton, my good friend Dave Guyton, is taking care of the Instagram page. If you want to find out more about me, you can go on Cochise County_Travels. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, so you can find out what's going there. My YouTube stuff, if you go there, you're going to be confused by it because there is a lot of blue-collar content, but there's also a lot of Wild West history content, including video of Jim and Burke, so you can see the mines in the area of Jim and Burke on my YouTube channel. Anything very go before we go? Are we going to see you anywhere? You got any special events besides the book signing in March?
Tucson's the next one that I know about, so Tucson Book Festival.
I am totally bummed that I'm not going to be there. But we'll catch up at another time.
All right.
And then, of course, I want to thank my friends at the Tombstone Epitaph, one of Arizona's longest-running newspapers at tombstoneepitaph.com, and my second family at the Wild West History Association. I urge you to join. Please join. It's just such a great group. If you're looking for factual history, the truth, and Western history, not the fake stuff, nothing that's going to be made up or fantasy, but the truth and Wild West history, go to wildwesthistory.org. As always, I appreciate you guys. Safe travels, and we'll see you soon.